I'm sure all of you are familiar with the adage of sorts that appears in the end credit roll of most pictures we've seen in the past 20 years. It goes something like, no animal was harmed in the course of making this motion picture, harmed or mistreated. Well, I'm Frank LaLoggia. I wrote, produced, and directed Lady in White. And I gotta tell you, this movie almost killed me. Okay, where do we begin? First of all, let me dispel any false rumors out there as to who this gentleman is in the long Italian coat. It is me. That is not Scorsese. That is not De Palma. That is me. Now, let me tell you how this came about. I had an actor on hire to do this little cameo at the front of the picture as the adult Frankie. And we were about, I'd say, halfway through the location portion of the shoot, and that was in upstate New York. And the crew was absolutely insistent upon me taking on the role. They said, I mean, it would only make sense, Frank. I mean, this is a story that has much to do with your past. It's so much autobiographical, and we want you to do this. So I said, all right. I will never appear in front of the camera again. If there is any part of this movie that makes me uncomfortable in the course of watching it, it is this sequence, and it simply has to do with me. I'm a behind the camera kind of guy. What can I say? But anyway, that is me, and I also have to say I've lost a lot of weight, a little chubby here, you know, so please, no cards or letters as relates to my figure. Okay, now let's get serious. This sequence was shot on Canandaigua Lake, an old stomping ground of mine, which is in upstate New York, just outside of Rochester, near the town of Batavia. And as a matter of fact, I brought this picture home, much as Frankie comes home, you know, to relive this experience of his past. I decided to go home as well to shoot this film. I grew up in Rochester, New York, and was an avid lover of movies when I was a kid. As a matter of fact, my cousin Charles and I, Charles was the executive producer of this film, we used to collect the old Castle 8mm condensed version movies that you could buy at the local department store when we were kids, and we loved the Universal horror classics. There was so much atmosphere and feeling. We would buy these films whenever we could wrestle up the money to do so. I think they cost about $4.50, $4.95 a piece. And we were so thrilled to get them home. Now, the only problem was they were silent, of course, and they ran at 18 frames per second. And we ran them on our parents' home movie projectors. And we wanted sound, so we would avidly keep our eye on the television guide week to week, and whenever The Bride of Frankenstein or Dracula or Son of Dracula popped up, we would make sure that we sat down with our reel-to-reel recorder and recorded the sound, and then we would spend hours on a weekend camping out at each other's houses. There's 3 years difference between us, and I'd say I was maybe 8, 9, he was 11, 12. And we would take 2 tape recorders and try to edit the track. This shot of the steeple and the town square with the city and the lake behind it is actually a triple layered optical. The live action is center, of course, that was shot location. And then we built a miniature tower that matched the actual church tower in the town square and created the matte painting and the lake for the backdrop. Lady in White was financed through a penny stock offering. I think it was the first and last time that anybody had ever made a picture this way. I was determined to see the picture through from beginning to end without any interference. I'd had a very unpleasant experience with my first film, Fear No Evil. Tremendous interference by the studio AFCO Embassy. Recut it. It was years before I could look at that picture and feel anything but dismay. I'm going easier on it these days. But with Lady, I wanted to make sure that nobody was telling me what I had to do for the sake of money concerns and or their own paranoid insecurities. And so my cousin Charles and I set up a penny stock company. We sold stock to finance Lady in White. The picture's budget was $4.7 million. We raised all the money ourselves, didn't make a deal up front, and later structured the deals when the picture was completed. And it's for that reason that I think Lady is a very personal experience for the audience, and certainly a fulfilling one for me.
Why you no eat something?
I'm not hungry.
Now, this is kind of funny. Lucas Haas plays Frankie. Renata Vanni is his grandmother. You'll see Frankie's mask here. I had asked my dear friend R.J. Silverthorne to create a mask that was representative of Bela Lugosi's guise in Dracula. And he worked very hard on it. And I thought he did a good job. Only to discover later that many people thought the mask looked like Nixon. Alex Rocca plays Frankie's dad, and I think he did a tremendous job here with this film. I cast him against type. I was a little unnerved initially to go with Alex because he's always kind of played the heavy. You know, Mo Green in The Godfather gets his eye shot out. But Alex loved this character. He came in and read for me. And after he finished the reading, there was a knock on the door about 10 seconds later, and it was him again. And he said, "Frank, I did a terrible job with this reading, and I hope you'll give me another chance because I am Angelo. This is so much a part of me. And I love this piece."
Go easy on him.
Well, he didn't do a terrible job with the reading. The fact is, I was most impressed and decided ultimately to go with Al. It was a good move. Now, Renata Vanni plays Mama Assunta, and Angelo Bertolini is Papa Charlie. As I said, much of Lady in White is autobiographical. And these two characters were based on my real-life Italian grandparents. On my father's side, I remember them so well. By the time we made Lady, they were both deceased. But all this interplay as regards the cigarette and her admonishing him for smoking, this all actually happened. We actually, as kids, used to have a wonderful time turning him in when we found him behind the shed. Smoked away to Mama Assunta. They were wonderful people. We went into production on Lady in White with scarcely one quarter of the entire monies we needed to finish the film. This was obviously a very scary enterprise. And that happened because the brokerage firm that was out there selling stock in the public entity suddenly closed down about 3.5 weeks prior to production. Well, we decided to move forward nonetheless. Nobody knew that we didn't have the money to complete the film immediately on hand. To my cousin Charlie's credit, he managed to find another brokerage firm while we were in production to jump back on board. But during this entire sequence you're seeing now, it was day-to-day throughout the shoot. But during this sequence, we've been shooting, I think, for about a week, and Charlie would come to the set with a handful of key brokers in hand, and I'd kind of step aside with him, have a little private conversation, and I'd ask him, "How'd we do today?" He'd say, "Not too good. Only raised about $15,000. I'd go back and put on a smile and continue to shoot. The next day he'd show up and we'd take that same little walk. And I'd ask him again, "How'd we do today?" And he said, not bad, $40,000. That's the way it was throughout the course of the shoot. It was unnerving, to say the least. The two brothers, Frankie and Gino, also were quite autobiographical. Frankie based in no small part on my character, my own personal character. And Gino, kind of a combination of my little brother and me as well. Because in actuality, the two of us were reversed. I was the older brother, and my brother Gino was the younger brother.
Look, don't tell Dad, he'll kill me.
Good, then maybe I get to live a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I changed a bit from an autobiographical standpoint was the setting for the film, the family setting as to where they live. We grew up in the inner city. My father's cinder block welding shop was right next door to our house, and I decided that I really wanted to contrast this idealistic kind of setting with the horror that was about to envelop my characters. And so I took Frankie's home and made it more of a pastoral kind of feel, gave it a pastoral setting. And I felt this would help to contrast the warms and the cools and feeling as it relates to the storytelling. This Cayman alligator was in no way mistreated or harmed during the shooting of this motion picture. This cemetery next to the school, it's interesting, over the years I've been asked, did that cemetery actually exist right next to the school? It's kind of a wonderful contrast. And I just lucked out. It very much was scripted to play this way. And we found this school in Phelps, New York, just outside of Rochester, with a cemetery sitting right next to it. I was very interested in creating a kind of a contrast and a juxtaposition of the warm and the cold from a lighting standpoint. I wanted colors at times to kind of clash and blend. In this particular case, it's fall, and of course we're in the Halloween season. And I made a very solid attempt to try to light the room in a manner that reflected what was happening outdoors, you know, with nature. I was always trying to create a certain blend in ambience, lighting-wise, in camaraderie with the season, with the interiors and the exteriors, because I felt they interrelated and were important to the feel and mood of the film. Now, this story, The Beast That Destroyed London, is a story that I actually wrote when I was in the third grade. I changed it a bit, of course, for the purpose of shooting, but for all intents and purposes, it's all there. And it may very well have been the beginning of the start of the screenplay for Lady in White. One day, I remember my nephew, Victor, phoning me from back east. I was living in Los Angeles. And he said, "Uncle Frank, I've been down in Grandma's basement, and I found this incredible story that you wrote called The Beast That Destroyed London." And I remembered it. I said, "Oh my gosh, where did you find that?" And he said, "Let me read it to you." And he did. I think that was about 2 years prior to my actually starting filming. But as best I can recollect, when I started to reflect on that story, he read it to me, we both laughed. I began to reflect on my past. And I wanted with Lady the opportunity to pay homage to my family, my upbringing, the people that were important to me in my life and continue to be, those of whom are still alive. And this story, I really think, was the springboard when Vic called me and read this story to me, to kind of getting me thinking about how I might devise conceptually an entertaining piece that would allow me to bring my real experiences into the foray.
Unless the monster had a baby. But that's impossible. Or is it?
That's Lucy Lee Flippin playing the teacher, Miss Ladella. Lucy had been a friend for a number of years prior to our making Lady in White. I always loved her whenever I saw her on film or on television. And I thought she was perfectly suited for this role.
And have a safe and happy Halloween. All right.
Ah, the cloakroom. if the story, The Beast That Destroyed London, that my dear nephew Victor phoned and read to me, kind of began my thinking as to the concept relating why I think that the image that was most compelling, that drove me forward in my mind's eye, was the image of Frankie in the cloakroom and the setting of the cloakroom, and particularly in a shot that's coming up in a little bit, him on the cloakroom shelf against the half window, the half moon window.
I really liked your story, Frankie.
If you take a look at the little girl's name tag on her desk, she is Mary Ellen, and we refer to her later in a later scene as Mary Ellen.
As weird as you.
Well, Mary Ellen was my first love. I remember being so completely enthralled with her in the third and fourth grade. And interestingly, once the picture was out there, it was about a year, I think, after the film had finished its theatrical run, I received a phone call at my home. And the woman on the other end said, "I'm looking for Frank LaLoggia." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Frank, this is Mary Ellen."
When do I get those?
Well, obviously I was shocked. And she told me a wonderful story as to how she came to see Lady in White. She said her niece had wanted to see the film. She had no idea that I was involved with it. Now, mind you, I had not seen this girl since the fourth grade. And so she took her niece to the movies, and she sat down. And she could not believe what she was witnessing. She, certainly Donald, Louis, Miss Ladella, all of the characters in the classroom setting were very familiar to her. And she said it moved her to tears. She was so incredibly moved. This scene was originally cut from the theatrical release of the film, and I made all the cuts. Originally, the picture came in at about 22 minutes, my first answer print did. And I determined that it was running a little long. So I took it back into the cutting room before we made all of our deals and made the cuts myself. For this version of Lady in White, I've put back about 6.5 minutes, and this was one of the scenes that I decided to put back with Frankie and Miss Ladella at the car.
Do what I told you. Let me do the talking.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Frankie. That was an okay story.
With some movies, something special happens in the course of making the film. It becomes more than just a job. Everybody gets behind the effort. Everybody falls in love with their work effort, with what they're doing as relates to this particular film. That's what happened with Lady in White. I was very, very fortunate to have that kind of energy come to this vehicle. And I think it lent the movie a very, very important edge, one of true caring on the part of everyone that was involved, the entire crew. Many of us remain in touch, as a matter of fact, and we all reflect fondly. That's not to say that things weren't difficult. Certainly at the point where we were 3.5 weeks away from production with so little money in the bank, I remember Charlie coming to Los Angeles from upstate New York where the money-raising effort was headquartered. And he had a room at the Universal Sheraton. And I remember joining him up there. He was on the 11th floor. I can tell you this, if that sliding glass window at that point had opened any more than the 6 appointed inches, we'd have both jumped. The movie came very close to never being made.
Jeez. Wish I were in love.
I'm gonna get my cap.
Donald! Get up here! Where'd he go?
I remember as a child, the inner city riots that took place in the early 60s. I remember being very frightened by the kinds of activities that were occurring just down the street from where we lived. there were riots, and I didn't understand what the basis for them was at all. But I knew that in creating the story for Lady, and certainly in focusing on my memories of the era, it was not an element that I could simply ignore. And so, this secondary story, if you will, involving the black janitor who is accused of the child murders, again sprung from my memories as a youth of the turmoil that was brewing in our community. I was a bit criticized by some of the critics for including this as part of the plotting for the film. To this day, I can't understand why. I've always felt that Lady is not a horror movie. That's not to say that I have any disregard for horror movies. I consider it a thriller, I suppose, a ghost story. If one had to label it, I'd veer much more, I think, toward those two signatures. But to me, it's more of a remembrance of time gone by. This cloakroom, by the way, was a cover set. By that I mean it was a set built apart and separate from the actual classroom, which was location. We shot the cloakroom sequences on location, but a cover set is a set that you use, that you build on a stage, and let's say it rains, you know, and you're scheduled to shoot outdoors, and you certainly can't because the script doesn't call for rain. You go indoors to your cover set. So that's what the cloakroom was. It afforded us the opportunity, whenever we ran into conditions that weren't amenable to what the script needed us to convey, we would go to our cloakroom cover set. Frankie at the cloakroom window, that I think was really key to the kind of feel I wanted to generate for the picture as a whole, right here.
Hey guys! Let me out of here!
The sequence that's coming up at the cloakroom window where day changes to night was a time-lapse sequence that we actually did in camera. Russ Carpenter, my director of photography, and I certainly discussed the entire look and visualization of the film, more than discuss. We storyboarded every shot in the film. Over 1,500 drawings were made. This is the way I've always worked. I feel that once you have the boards, you know, you have something to stray from should you need to. But this was all done in camera, that sequence you just saw, with the camera locked down. We waited for the light to change outdoors and augmented with our own lighting to help create the effect. And did it all in camera. I wanted to make sure that we didn't get a grainy, second-generational kind of look and feel that an optical would bring to that. Had we gone optical. This was a rather interesting sequence from the point of view of set design. I wanted to shoot this as one shot, with Frankie approaching the casket, and doing this dolly around the casket, and ultimately moving into the next room. This was a set that we built in Los Angeles when we finished our location. We came back to Los Angeles and shot for a number of weeks on stage. And this nightmare sequence involving Frankie's mom's funeral. And here we go, we're moving into the bedroom now with his mother. This was all done in one shot, and what we did was we had the adjacent set, the bedroom set adjacent, and adjoining, and we opened some sliding panels once the camera was on Frankie, and that allowed us to dolly through. Actually, we were on Steadicam, to Steadicam through those panels and into the adjoining set, and not have to break up the continuity of the shot. So this is all still one shot from the point of the dissolve into Frankie's dream all the way through this. And then what we did, I wanted to continue to dolly around them, and you see we simply slammed those panels shut back there quietly. And there you have it. We're still in one shot.
How could I ever leave you?
That doesn't look like Nixon to me. Okay, here we're about to introduce Melissa, the little girl ghost. I thought I should comment on how did you ever see a dream walking came into play as regards to storytelling. It's kind of an odd story. I was in the process of kind of working out the story in my mind's eye. I hadn't begun to write script yet. And I was in my apartment in Los Angeles. And I think American Movie Classics was running a film called Roman Scandal with Eddie Cantor. And I'd never seen an Eddie Cantor picture, so I thought, oh, maybe I'll give this a watch. And I sat down and began to watch it, and the song was featured in that film. Well, as soon as I heard it, it all just clicked. It really helped to drive me home from the point of view of finalizing the story and concept for Lady.
Who are you?
I also wrote the music for Lady in White. I scored the picture with synthesizers initially, and then took the orchestrations, the synthesized orchestrations, to my orchestrator for full acoustic. And we scored with a 70-piece orchestra. Music has always been very important to me in the flow of my storytelling. These effects involving the little girl ghost were black screen. We would shoot the cloakroom locked down without her in it, and then shoot her action against black so that we could later composite the two optically and control the degree of her transparent kind of quality. I love that shot of Frankie's eyes. They say so much. My effects budget for the film was somewhere in the vicinity of $200,000. I had over 125 effects shots. And I must admit, one of the things that I've always been a little disappointed with was not having had the money to perhaps make the effects a little cleaner. But in an odd way, I don't think that works against the film.
Thank you.
this rodent was not mistreated or harmed in the course of making this motion picture. As a matter of fact, he was very well trained to follow a certain set along his course, prescribed by me, of course. Now, why don't they have a society for the prevention of cruelty to directors? I think that's something somebody should consider pulling together. If any of my peers out there agree with me, give me a call. Let's get it going.
Who are you? What do you know?
I got locked in. My friends locked me in after school, and...
The heart sound was fading, becoming faint, more distant. I was dying. I could feel my eyes close shut, and yet I continued to see...
This sequence of Frankie's near-death experience was one of the most challenging to film. This was shot against blue screen. We felt that would be a better way to go with these sequences from the point of view of controlling the image later, optically, in the printer. And I wanted this to have the feel of the, you know, the house in the tornado sequence, flying sequence in The Wizard of Oz, in a visceral kind of way, although what's driving it thematically is a little different.
I saw my father waiting for me to return home from school, worriedly dialing numbers to try and locate me.
I used to refer to this as the Icarus sequence.
I saw my brother Gino sadly sifting through my toys and clothes and finding the love letter I'd written to Mary Ellen. Why didn't I give it to her?
For this new special edition of Lady in White, we actually went back into this sequence and did some additional sound work. Adding some effects that I always felt it was missing and in need of. I think it worked out quite well. Now, here we are, back on the set, one of our sets, in Los Angeles. We built this woods. This was something I never even remotely considered doing, that is, shooting the woods sequences, any of the woods sequences, in an actual wood, because I needed to control what was going on atmospherically. I wanted the woods to have a real Grimm's fairy tale kind of feel. Remember, the story is told from the point of view of an adult who has become a writer of fiction, of thrillers, if you will. And it's all kind of refracted. It's through his memory as an adult, if indeed this event did occur to him, as he responded to these circumstances as a little boy. So I felt as though that gave me an extra edge. It wasn't simply a matter of trying to position the look and feel of the film from the point of view of the child, because we were coming at it from an adult storyteller's point of view. And I liked that aspect of it. I felt as though I could take certain liberties and perhaps do things a little differently than your typical kid's point of view kind of movie.
Don't you know where you'd like to be going?
My home, in my own bed.
When you're working on a budget, you have to be inventive. And in this particular case, we have this reflective material that we simply let drop from the drops and made sure that our lights were positioned to catch it. I think it works quite well, you know, lends a nice, distinct visual kind of air. Lady in White, thematically speaking, is about loss, let's face it. That, I think, is the thing that drives the picture first and foremost. It was always, from the point of view of my writing the screenplay. Everybody in this film has suffered a loss. Frankie's lost his mom, his father's lost his beloved wife. Ultimately, Mrs. Williams loses her husband. And what I wanted to do was try to tell a story that dealt with coming to terms with loss, something we all have to face in a positive way. This is kind of a funny story. Alex Rocca's first scene was this scene outside the school. When he appeared on the set that evening, we embraced, and he said, "Boy, I'm excited. I can't wait to get going." And I said, "Okay, here's what you do. You walk up into this close-up. You've got tears in your eyes. We discussed this because you've almost lost your boy. And you've just recovered him from the cloak." He said, "Okay, Frankie. Okay, I got it." Well, I kind of look out of the corner of my eye, and I see him walking over to makeup people. And I walk over to listen to hear what he's about to say. And he says, "You got any of that stuff you put in your eyes, you know, the tears, the glycerin?" And I took him aside and I said, "Al, what did I just hear you ask for?" He said, "You know, Frankie, that stuff." I said, "You come with me." We went back into the school, reserved a cloakroom, a room, specifically for ourselves. And when he came out, those were real tears. I won't tell you how I did it.
Santa Maria, Madre Dio, per noi peccatori.
This is an image I recall directly from my youth, saying my prayers with my grandma, rosary in hand. Renata Vani, who plays Mama Assunta, and Angelo Bertolini, who plays Papa Charlie, were just wonderful together. This is another scene that I'd lifted originally from the theatrical version of the film and put back in. I just adored it and felt as though I wanted to get a little bit more of the two of them into this version of the picture. But what's interesting about them is I wanted the real thing. These are not fake accents. And I drove Lynn Stallmaster, the casting director, fairly crazy. I said, "Please don't bring me any actors who are going to attempt to fake an authentic Italian accent. We've got to find the real thing." Well, we did. Ultimately, we did. Renata was Napolitan, and Angelo was Sicilian, which caused for no little tension between them at times. It's a natural sort of thing, if you understand Italian history, and lent wonderfully to their characters and their interplay. This scene of Angelo with the cigarette on the screen, we rehearsed this time and time again just to get the timing right. And I have framed at my home 2 8x10s of Angelo hitting the screen just right with a cigarette and me showing him how to do it. One of the things that quite often dismays me as regards the portrayal of Italian Americans on film is these stereotypes which Hollywood tends to veer toward. It's not only as relates to this ethnic group, but others as well. And I wanted to portray the family as I experienced my family and many others in my immediate family. We weren't gangsters. They were hardworking people who fought hard to assimilate and yet retain their inherent nature. I miss them all deeply. And sadly, my father, whom I based Angelo on, did not live to see this film. My mother did, thankfully. And my grandparents were both deceased by the time the picture was made, long deceased. But I remember when we took the film back to Rochester for the premiere screening at the George Eastman House, and my aunts and the surviving old-timers in the family came to see it. They were absolutely blown away. My aunts were in tears because they had no idea what it was I was up to. They had no idea that they were about to experience their loved ones alive again, miraculously, up on the screen.
I wasn't calling him names.
You want to talk, Gino? You call him a frog.
I didn't call him a frog. I call him a toll.
What's the difference?
I give up. Where's the food? Charlie, go smoke a cigarette. Stop making trouble. Go ahead.
Oh, first she tells me you're going to die for smoke. And now she's going to sing at my funeral, huh?
That's right. Huh? I'm not going to sing at your funeral. I'm going to throw on top of the dirt so I get rid of you, my face.
Huh? Mannaggia la miseria, ecco.
This is a set. Just about all of the interiors in Lady in White were built, well, certainly all of the interiors as relates to the house, with the exception of the living room where the Christmas tree appears later. That was shot location at the actual farmhouse. But Frankie's room, the hallway, the kitchen, these were all built. Jason Presson plays Frankie's brother Gino, and I just think he's wonderful in the film. There's a naturalness about him that is so impressive. And when the two of them got together and read for me in the office, they just hit it off beautifully. It's as though they'd known each other for years. And you can't buy that kind of rapport between actors. It just has to be there, and I always look for that. It's very important to me that the blend of personalities comes together and contributes to the characterization.
Hello? Oh, yes, just a minute. Angelo! La polizia.
Hello?
I remember the day I went to Lyons, New York, which is the location for the town square, and this courthouse is located on the square, and we shot the interior of the courthouse on the square. And I was with my art director, Carl Zolo, and it was a spring day, and I'd gone back to complete my scout and determine where it was I wanted to shoot the film. And I said, this is it. Well, there was a woman who appeared on the courthouse steps, and she approached Carl Zolo, the art director, and asked what we were doing, because I was there with my director's finder, and he was snapping photographs. And Carl said to her, well, we're going to make a movie here if all goes well. The next thing I knew, I turned to hear this woman screaming ecstatically, running back up the steps into the courthouse, shouting, they're going to make a movie in Lyons! And shortly thereafter, people started to filter out and come and say hello. This is a very small town, population, I'd say, about 3,000. And it was quite a big event for them.
Ten-year-old Melissa Ann Montgomery.
Lucas Haas was always my first choice for Frankie. And at the time we were casting the film, he was quite the hot child actor. He was the child actor. He'd done Witness, and to great response, both audience-wise and critically. And I always felt he could pull it off. I felt that he was not a young actor who was prone to television gimmickry when it came to performing, you know, mugging, that sort of thing. And I was so happy when we got the script to his parents, who were his guardians, and taking a look at the material that was being submitted to him, quite a bit was, and they responded. We did not have a lot of money to pay. We were on a very tight budget. As I may have mentioned, the picture was made for $4.7 million with no studio backing, no pre-sales of any kind. And when they agreed to move forward, shared, of course, the script with Lucas, and he liked it as well, it made my day.
Neil, why you call Frankie?
This is Len Carreyrou in the middle as Phil. Because Mama. I had been a fan of Len's ever since, I'd say about 1980, when I saw Sweeney Todd in New York. I was living in New York City at the time, cutting my first film, Fear No Evil. And saw Sweeney Todd when it was at the Eurus Theater, and was blown away by the show and by Len and his performance. And so when it came to casting Phil, the thought occurred to me that he would be wonderful. And we flew Len out after we'd sent him the script. He liked the script very much, from New York, and spent some time with him. And he said, I love this, and I love what you're attempting to do, and I want to do this. And I was ecstatic. It should be said that in Hollywood, it's sometimes very difficult to get around agents and managers who seem to see only dollars. as opposed to, you know, the experience of what good picture making can bring to their clients. Now, all of the actors worked for considerably less than they'd worked for in a long time. They had to if they wanted to be involved with this project. And I have to credit them. All of them fought their representatives. It was one after the other to ultimately tell them, look, I believe in this guy. I believe in what he's trying to do. And just make the deal. And I remember Len's agent at the time, I can't remember who it was holding us up. And finally, Len got on the phone personally. He was in my office one day, and he got on the horn. I heard him say it. And he said, just make the deal. And that was it. Again, you can't buy that. You can't buy that kind of wanton and desire. There's just something magical that happens sometimes with movies, where the people get behind you. That happened with Lady.
How's Frankie?
This scene with Len and Alex has always been one of my favorites. And interestingly, when I screened the picture initially for audience, when it was completed, I always hoped that they would feel what I was feeling about this scene. And what I'm talking about has to do with the love, the incredible love, and the connection that these two grown adult men feel for one another. And when Alex breaks down and allows his fear and his anxiety to come through in his discussion with Phil here and let it show, I mean, it's rarely that you see two grown men this raw. And it really blew audiences away. I've heard many comments over the years as relates to this. My God, that scene. It's interesting. I think that there's a bit of a threat to the macho, you know, at times when you see two men sharing their feelings in this way. I consider it the ultimate strength.
A lot of mixed emotions. But questa la vita. Eventually you grow up. You grow out of them. I used to think fear was something you grow out of, like being afraid of the dark. But now with Marion gone, you know, Philly, the thing that scares me the most is the thought of losing one of my kids.
This television console was actually dug up from my mother's basement. This was an old TV set that we had when I was growing up. And the phonograph that's featured later in the film, which is a part of it, it's all co-joined. That came from my mother's basement. I remembered the piece sitting down there, having been covered up all these years, and asked her if we could use it in the film. It was perfect. It was what I reflected on as I was writing the scene. Ah, the Universal horror film monsters. Yes. I remember as a kid cementing these wonderful figures together and painting them up with my dad. And I wanted to resurrect them for the film, for Frankie's bedroom. And when we attempted to relocate my own models in the basement of my mother's home, we found them to be in pieces. It seems my nephews and my niece had played with them long after I'd grown up and pretty much done them in. But a second cousin of mine in Florida told me that he kept his in pretty good shape and so was kind enough to send them along.
Did you ever hear a dream talking while I
The walking slippers was accomplished by monofilament. And we were sure to cover the filament with appropriate lighting. Now, this sequence involving the condensation on the window was actually shot with a mirror. So, let me see if I can clearly explain this. The camera was shooting through glass into a mirrored reflection, and one of the assistant prop people had a black glove on, and we made sure he wasn't lit behind the glass, and condensation was provided by another machine, and he drew the heart on with his finger. Once again, we're on the wood set built at Raleigh Studios in Hollywood. And Catherine Helmond plays Amanda Harper. Catherine was a friend. We'd met Catherine, Charlie, and I when we were making Fear No Evil. One of the backers on that film was very tight with she and her husband, David Christian. And Catherine was such a great help, a very supportive, lent herself to a promotional reel that we put together and appeared in it for us. We used that reel as a tool to get the brokers excited and get the money together for Lady in White. This cottage was built location. The exterior was location. When I work with an actor or a crew member and they serve me well, I'm very loyal. I always try to bring them back. And this is my dear friend Jack Holland playing the priest in this scene. Jack since passed away. Jack was in Fear No Evil. That's when we met, my first feature film. So I brought Jack back for this. Interesting side note as concerns this church, certainly as regards plotting, all of the blacks are relegated to the back of the church. It was a segregated scenario from the point of view of plotting and script. Well, afterwards, all of these townspeople, these extras, were local townspeople. As we were getting them together to bring them into the church, I noticed that all of the blacks, without any direction from me, moved toward the back of the church and seated themselves. Now, I was shocked. I came to find out that on Sunday services, this was still something that was occurring. It was not spoken of. It just happened naturally in real life as we were shooting. And that was back in 1987. So this was still happening.
Your boy's no better than mine. That murderer of hers that killed him. Now he's gonna die too. I spit on you. I spit on your murdering husband.
Russ Carpenter, my DP on the film, was, I think, so instrumental to bringing a marvelous feel and texture to the film. We spent a lot of time together. As I said, we storyboarded the picture out together, discussing the look and feel, the lighting, the color rendering. And Russ has since gone on. This is virtually his first feature, to become one of the top DPs in Hollywood. Among others, he shot Indian in the Cupboard and True Lies and is currently shooting Titanic with Cameron. Now, this is a sequence that I had originally cut from the theatrical release of the film and decided to put back.
Oh,
The Williams children were local kids that we cast. And Rose Weber plays Mrs. Williams. Again, a marvelous rendering, I thought. Fine actress. Rose is also a lounge singer. I mean, that's really her driving ambition, and she's had quite a bit of success as a singer, as a vocalist. It's interesting because she's such a glamorous gal, and we dress both her and Catherine Hellman down significantly. It takes some courage as an actress to allow a director, well, first of all, to take on a part that demands a certain look that's not exactly flattering, and to allow the director to proceed. I've worked with some actresses that are more concerned about their look from the point of view of just looking as young as possible and as flattering as possible than they are character. We shot Lady in White in September, at the end of September, began shooting, I believe it was September 29th, 1986, and wrapped early 1987. The picture was ultimately released in April of 1988. And I went with a smaller theatrical distributor. I had to split up the ancillaries, as they say, make separate deals for various distribution concerns. I had screened the picture for a number of studios. Just about everybody saw it in its completed form. There were two major studios that were interested in taking the film on, but both of them wanted to mess with the cut, and I simply couldn't allow that to happen. And so I decided ultimately to go with a smaller distributor that was willing to allow me to leave it alone. As a result, the picture's theatrical distribution suffered. Originally, we were going to open the film in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. And at the last minute, the distributor decided that they were not going to open New York. It was just going to be too expensive, conjointly with Chicago and L.A. Well, we wanted to have the national reviews. We had screened the picture for the national critics, and all of them were indicating that they very much liked the film. But the National Critics, Time, Newsweek, People magazine, that were so important, would not run their review unless the picture opened New York.
Oh, go! You go to the stairs. Up, there.
Christmas was coming, and all the preparations had begun. Mama baked Christmas cookies for the decorating ceremonies.
Hey, Mama, what's that?
Phil brought the tree, just as he had every year.
Yeah. Mama!
That's it. Dad and Gino.
This is really interesting. The sequence involving the snow outdoors. It was scripted to play this way, and we had snow machines, everything ready to create our snow. And guess what? That was the one day on the shoot when it snowed. It was the first snow that season. It didn't snow again throughout the rest of the location shoot. And so nature provided me with my snow.
I'd grown up just a little bit more than I was supposed to, I think. Responsibility had become my constant companion. And I was no longer afraid of things I could not see.
Psychologically speaking, Frankie's encounter with Melissa, the little girl ghost, I wanted to create a certain feel as to whether or not this was all happening within the boy's mind, and really, perhaps could not be happening at all in reality. And yet, I wanted to walk that fine line and ultimately take my audience and my story to the other side. And I found this very intriguing and a very delicate balance. By the other side, I mean ultimately allow them to experience and him to experience the ghost for what she is, a real entity and presence. Nonetheless, I think that the idea of the little girl ghost, from the point of view of working through the terrible loss of his mother, and ultimately being able to move on and become an adult who can accept loss and continue, was what was very much driving me.
The heaven in my arms was you.
I kept this prop, this little angel ornament, and have it in a prominent place in my home. And I always smile when I take a look at it. I always love this shot because, oh, it's just so overblown from the point of view of the decorative, you know. It's what this family would have done, perhaps overdone it a bit, with the lights and what my family would have done. And all the cutout reindeer. This is one of my favorite sequences in the film, transitionally speaking. It works so well for me.
Everybody's gotta have a place to be alone.
Originally, there was a scene with the postman, an extensive scene involving dialogue between he and Frankie. And I chose not to put this scene back in for this special edition. In creating these dissolves, and this mood with music and sound, a little bit of narrative, to get across what I needed to get across in visual terms. And that's what movies are all about. I'm always striving for the visceral, but not always for the visceral that comes from pure shock, you know, and surprise. Certainly, there's plenty of that here, but the moments in the film that I most love are the ones that are quiet.
You know, I dropped off that package you've been waiting for.
You did?
Uh-huh. All the way from Lincoln, Nebraska. Right.
When I go to see a film, I kind of... the analogy that I make in my mind's eye and from the point of view of feeling has to do with a roller coaster ride. I love a great roller coaster ride. There's a wonderful old wooden roller coaster in upstate New York, in my hometown, the Jackrabbit at Seabreeze on Lake Ontario, and I always enjoy riding that coaster when I go home. And movies are like roller coasters, you know, you got your peaks and your valleys, and you must allow for those peaks and valleys. You must allow yourself to be quiet and build, in this case, as regards this story, to the scenes that are horrific. I'm not a bombastic kind of guy, I when it comes to my storytelling. At least I try not to be.
All I'm saying is, unless Frankie can verify that it wasn't Williams that attacked him...
Come on, Ray, you've talked to Frankie. He told you it was too dark to tell.
They're gonna put Harold Williams away, I guarantee.
Where's their
it.
Proof?
He was in the building, Al. What the hell was he doing there in the middle of the night?
He got drunk and passed out.
His goddamn prints were all over that cloakroom.
And all over
the desk in this scene was my father's desk. My mother had kept it in the basement of our home in upstate New York. Another prop that I managed to resurrect from our archive, family archive. And it's important to me that it's in this scene. And that the character of Angelo is portrayed by Alex Rocco is seated at my dad's desk. He sat there for 40-some-odd years, working his tail off to support us.
Ten years ago, we found what in that cloakroom? It matched her type. I know that she was killed there.
Hey, what's going on?
Still!
Whoa, calm down, partner.
There was a little girl. I saw her. She was killed in the cloakroom. Sheriff Saunders knows it. Then I heard something.
The shop, the welding shop. It was really important to me that a certain aural presence that I remembered so distinctly be a part of the sequences involving the welding shop. So you hear the grinding saws and the sound of hammers against metal. I grew up with that. Our house was right next door, and I woke to that. It was like music to my ears, quite frankly, because it was my father's work. It never bothered any of us. Nobody ever complained about it. And he would come home at the end of a hard day, you know, just covered with soot and dust and grime. Never complain. Go downstairs to the basement, get out of his clothes, his dirty clothes, hang them up. My mother'd have a fresh set ready for him the next day. And always that constant boom, 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 almost like a heartbeat. It should be obvious to everyone by now that I was raised Roman Catholic. And although I've had a bit of dissension in my regard for the church at times in my life, I treasure the wonderful kinds of memories that I have as relates to my parents' faith. The scene involving everybody at dinner was just so typical. We used to go to my grandparents' home every Sunday, and I'll tell you, if we didn't show up, Mama Cinta and Papa Charlie, Mama especially, took my father to task.
Somebody's been into my trunk again.
Lots of laughter and arguing and more laughter. And one of the things I remember was the soda pop, the orange pop. And I insisted that that's what the kids served themselves. There's Frankie taking a sip of his orange pop.
Where's Pa?
He's gunning himself because I hide these cigarettes.
I hope you take off your new wristwatch before you drown yourself.
Son of a bitch!
That's it!
Come out and eat!
Oh, shut up!
All right? Strict.
Did you find your cigarettes? I put them in the drain.
Interestingly, this house was a location that was scouted by my art director, Carl Zolo. And can you imagine finding a more suitable presence, considering what the script demanded? It had sat there abandoned for a number of years, and it seems that something quite unmentionable occurred as regards its owners. There was a murder. And so the house had been relegated to... to resort to the wild, I suppose. Nobody was interested in buying it or having anything to do with it. Well, it took some managing on our part to get the owner to allow us to shoot there.
You want to come?
No. I promised my dad I'd be home before dark. Besides, I have to finish delivering these greeting cards. What's the matter?
Jared rushed in, who plays Donald in the leather jacket. This was his first feature-length motion picture, and as a result of his performance in this film, went on to star with Tom Hanks in Big. This was a model of a windmill, and we actually provided a real windmill for the back of the cottage there.
Hey, I'd kill myself too if I deliver in a spooky joint like that.
Shh.
Jeez.
We built the cottage facade and also built the interior for shooting purposes on location.
Look at what I found.
You know, I remember having a Cayman alligator as a kid as well. We kept him in the basement in the sink down there for a while. Then he mysteriously disappeared. I'm not sure exactly what happened to him, but I think my mother had managed to compel my father to find him a new home, shall we say. She wasn't too keen. By the way, no Cayman alligator was harmed in any way throughout the making of this motion picture. As a matter of fact, the animal handler was, for that shot of the alligator flying and coming back down, was right there with a blanket wrapped in his arm, and I guarantee you that he fell very lightly into the handler's arms. Right from the beginning of conceptualizing our visual approach toward Lady, Russ and I had talked about creating light changes as we were shooting, and for this purpose we needed to bring in dimmer panels, and we had a huge light board for this sequence that allowed us to bring the lights up and down, the sequences coming up, and also for the sequence in the woods later on when Frankie is being pursued. I'm all for doing anything one can to convey what needs to be conveyed visually in camera or on camera as you're shooting. There's something about opticals. They're often quite necessary, but I really enjoy the nuance of suggestion. And it takes a little bit more thinking and perhaps a little bit more effort to try to create a mood in a scene such as this without the help of opticals. But when you can pull it off, here comes the light change. I think that says it all. There's a presence here now, something that wasn't here before.
Real slow.
I'm not touching that thing.
Would you just do what I
told? I think that our fears as children are probably the most compelling of all. They remain with us, you know, throughout all of our lives. And this scene involving Catherine's appearance as the spooky Amanda always caused audiences to scream. I can remember being in the theater, adults as well as children, and hearing them peek with shrieks as she's descending the stairs, and it was always such a kick for me.
Guys?
Again, I think that the reason it worked so well, and she's on a platform that moves that we built into the stairs, we kind of cranked her down, is that the film has created enough of an ambiance and mood to allow you up to this point to really suspend your disbelief and kind of reflect back on the fears of childhood and experience them again, even though they, as a mature adult, one would be hard pressed to consider them as anything but fantasy. Okay, a cheap shot, I admit, but it always gets an oh, at least from the male audience members.
Save my unborn child. She won't be doing undercovers for a while.
I love this dialogue between the two of them. To me, it just helps to make them real as brothers.
Who?
The lady in white.
What?
Melissa's mother is the lady in white.
Who's Melissa?
Melissa Montgomery.
10 years ago, she was killed in the cloakroom. I saw it happen.
Are you going to tell Dad I do it under the covers? Because if you do, I'll tell him you went into his trunk. I have proof.
Listen to me!
Mom used to say, sometimes when someone dies violent, they can't rest in peace.
I always feel myself motivated story-wise by the kinds of tales that allow me to, or would allow me to, create a visual sense of ambiance and mood. That's so important to me. This medium has so much to offer, and it is a visual medium. And yet I find so many American-made mainstream movies so dry and without any real nuance as far as look and feel goes.
It's a graduating ring like the one Chicky got last summer, but very old.
Well, come on, Toad. You better get back before Dad lynches us both.
But Gino, I've got to find it. It's the only thing
come
that'll...
Come on, I'm tired. You know what? I heard the weatherman say it's going to snow in Tobin County. Might get lucky.
Certainly my screenplay, The Giant, the story of the creation of the David by a very youthful Michelangelo, aged 26 to 29, will afford me ample opportunity to create a sense of mood and atmosphere with visuals. What a marvelous period in history that was, and what an incredible story it is. This basement set was just that, a set, created on stage. I thought the art department did a really nice job with it. This is another little scene that I decided to put back in the picture. It was in the original theatrical cut, but was shorter. As a matter of fact, in the original theatrical cut, I believe I cut out of the scene at Frankie's noticing the typewriter right here. This is the extended footage. You know, it's tough ultimately when you've got to make decisions related to editing your movie down. The first cut of Lady in White was, I'd say about 2 hours and 40 minutes. But my intent was to just cut it all in as I shot it, and then whittle away. That's a process. It takes a lot of thought, a lot of consideration, a lot of experimenting, taking the picture out, screening it, bringing it back to the cutting room. And unfortunately, there's a lot of money involved. Time means money, especially when you're making a picture for a studio. And you've got huge, huge budgets and post-production budgets to contend with. But there's simply no substitute for taking the time to do it right. The trick is to relegate the money accordingly so that you will have the time. You've got to be able to know how to do that. And I credit Andy LaMarca, who is my co-producer and lady, with giving me the best bang for the buck.
It's okay, Papa. It's Gino.
Andy was someone who had come to me with a screenplay of his own that he had hoped to produce. It would have been his first feature, and was interested in whether or not I might direct the film. Well, I read the screenplay. I wasn't much impressed, but I was really impressed with Andy. And when we put together the promotional reel for Lady in White, we did that for, I think, about $23,000. That Charlie and I mustered up before we began raising money. I asked Andy if he would help me. I asked him if he would contribute his knowledge and expertise to the production of that reel. He did, and I promised him that I would take him with me when we made the feature. I did, and he's since gone on to become a top producer in Hollywood.
She wants her mother.
Once again, the little girl was shot against black, with lockdown camera for the background play to the room.
Her mother is the lady in white.
Well, getting back to the optical effects, I always liked the way this sequence worked. I thought it worked very well, her approach to the window and floating through. You know, it's amazing, really, when you consider all the effort and time and thinking that goes into planning. There's just no feeling like it, certainly from my perspective. Ultimately, seeing your picture completed, coming together, working. And when audience responds, my gosh, it's just an amazing feeling. This special effects sequence was a little tricky because all the boys were looking at, really, well, they weren't looking at anything at all. We had a lockdown of the stairwell. We had to give them a certain eye level to follow. Of course, the image of the ghost did not exist before them. That all came later. She was shot against black and then optically matted in. And we had to make sure that ultimately when we put those two images together, the boys and the matted ghost, that we maintained a certain eye level in the printing so that it looked like they were actually following her image out through that door.
Let's go home.
No. Don't you
it's
see?
Difficult enough, I think, for adult actors to be able to relate to many of the requirements of what is needed to perform special effects.
Toad, wait!
You know, looking at things that don't exist, that happen months later as a result of all kinds of effort. But when kids have to do it, I was always stunned at Lucas's comprehension of the picture as a whole. It was not a piecemeal thing for him, and working with him was a remarkable experience. With the other two boys, I had to give them a little bit more effort and time to guide them, but Lucas was always right on, and really, with him, it took just a little bit of a whisper in the ear, you know, to get him on track. A remarkable talent. When I made my theatrical distribution deal, we had to submit the picture for a rating, you know, to the MPAA. And astoundingly, they viewed the picture in New York and came back with an R rating. Well, I was horrified. I could not understand this at all. We decided to fight it. And I flew to New York, and an attorney was hired, and a child psychologist was hired. And it really all hinged on me, though. It was up to me to ultimately explain why it was that I felt the picture should not be rated R. And what I essentially said to them was that this was a film about a young man who is facing some horrible realities as regards life, as all children ultimately have to. We all have to. But he's such an heroic figure. He's such a fighter, he's such a winner, that I think this is important. I wanted children, not very young children, but certainly preteens, to be able to experience this, to find in Frankie an heroic, truthful, honest role model. And interestingly, The MPAA, the board, absolutely loved the film, and many of them were hoping that this new group of of deciders that they'd assembled for this second screening of my presentation would give the picture a PG-13. Luckily, they did. And it was one of the first times that that had ever happened, that a reversal had occurred from an R to a PG-13. I think the thing that really compelled them to go with the R initially was that they were so intensely moved by this film. It was genuinely frightening to them as adults, and I think they felt that it might be as well to children. Ah, yes, the humidifier. I can remember countless occasions when I was struck by a bug, and that infernal contraption would spew all kinds of condensation, heated mist into the room, and I would sweat like a dog as a kid. But it did relieve the congestion somewhat.
3:30. That's what I said.
I think the humidifier has gone the way of the Edsel.
Why didn't you wake me up for school?
Why? I tell you why. You're so sick, you don't remember that you shook all over this morning.
I did?
I think maybe you got pneumonia. Oh, God forbid. Because all night the window was open. Here.
Where's Frankie?
Pascola. What do you think?
It was important to me that I really struggled to make every moment real, as real as I remembered it. And I think these kids, Jason's reaction right there, everything he's conveying from the point of view of his concern, struck me as being so right on. Another remarkable young child actor.
It's temper, Mama. I've got a temperature.
And me too. So don't make me mad.
Yeah. Arrivederci, Mama.
Here's another scene I extended for the sake of this special edition. Originally, it was cut from the theatrical release. Starts right here. I always loved it and thought
too
to put it back.
No work. Come on, Gilda, we try the other end.
No, Mama.
Come on.
Oh. Ow!
Signore mio.
Thanks, Johnny.
Nick!
What's up?
We're letting him go. Grand jury refused to indict.
Insufficient evidence.
Have to be. DA's mad as hell.
Interesting story involving this sequence. When I made my deal with the theatrical distributor, of course, the deal absolutely necessitated that they not lay a hand on the picture editorially. But as we were preparing to release the film theatrically, the president of the company came to me and said that he really did not feel that the black man should die, Mr. Williams should be shot here. He felt it was in tenor inappropriate for the film. And I was faced with a dilemma. I certainly had no intention of changing this. It's one of, I think, the most shocking moments in the film, and realistic. And so I was faced with a dilemma, and that was, do I stick to my guns, contractually unprotected, and risk the possibility that their enthusiasm from a marketing perspective, you know, will falter, and they won't give the picture the push it needs? Or do I strike a little bargain? Well, I decided to strike a bargain. I said they could go ahead and set up two screenings back to back. They can choose their venue and bring in their audience for response. And the only change I would make, I would go back in and cut in the two versions, was I would let the black man free. I would not allow his death to occur. Well, that was the only difference between the two versions, and of course they submitted their questionnaires as relates to response to the audience members in each theater. And my version was so much better received that they ultimately had to concede. Now, what this is all about has to do with paying off story-wise. It just did not make sense. The whole intent of this subplot, if you will, involving the black family, had to ultimately peak with this tragic incident. And in another sense, it was important that, viscerally speaking, I take the audience from a certain lull and comfortability at this point in the movie, and shocked them to such an extent as to cause them to become unnerved. I wanted to take them from a nice, passive, kind of relaxed mood at this point and bring them up 10 notches so that I had them there 10 notches higher than they would have been with the gunshot and his assassination all the way through the end of the picture. I wanted them to be that much on edge. And I knew that viscerally it would affect the feel, the audience experience of the entire climax of the picture. There was no way we could lose it. It was a gamble, but it paid off.
I'll never be that good.
Nah, just takes a little practice, that's all. You have to train your mind not.
This is remarkable. We went out to grab this shot with a couple of the stand-ins, Russ and I, one Sunday afternoon. Watch the cloud cover. Watch what happens here. Again, nature came to my assistance. It's so remarkable the way it enhances the mood of the impending revelation. That cloud passing over the sun and blanketing the scene in shadow.
All right.
Good.
Listen carefully to what Len Carreyrou has to say to Lucas in this short sequence as he's bowing up.
Left arm straight. That's it.
Knowing full well, of course, I'm assuming you've seen the picture without this commentary, who he is and what he's done.
Pull back.
I wanted to allude in the dialogue to what he might have been feeling. Essentially, his own directive as concerns himself in his mind's eye when he was murdering these children.
Yeah. Not bad. Not bad at all.
I don't believe it.
We're going to make a marksman out of you yet, Broken Arrow. Well, let's pack up. You take these things, I'll get to target.
Okay.
The idea of Len as the antagonist of the piece, Uncle Phil, if you will, the trusted family friend, to me lent, once again, a very, very real edge to the tragedy of child abuse. I think we know, more often than not, that it can be the people we know or trust that turn out to be the ones we should trust least.
Hey, Frankie. What's the matter? Come on. Open the door.
please. Frankie.
I told Len I wanted him in this one shot, right here. I wanted to see the transformation from man to beast. And I think he gave it to me.
Open the door! Open the goddamn door!
Window breaking, little technical aside, we attached a charge to it, and so it was up to our special effects guy to explode that charge just as Len's elbow hit it. And here we are back on our set, our woods. Again, my intent was never to try to portray a realistic wood, but to lend a real Grimm's fairy tale kind of feel to this wood.
Now, please. I'm not going to hurt you.
This is the scene I was referring to earlier where once again we employed a dimmer board to get the lights to dim and fade and change in their color rendering. What I was going for here was a feeling. I did not even for a moment consider that this would be realistically something that could happen, this change from day to night as it does here.
I mean, if I'd known it was you, I never would have come. No. Frankie, don't.
That's the real church tower, by the way, as you can see. We did pay attention to detail as regards the model that we built for the opening title sequence. It was so much fun being in the theater with an audience watching the film progress to this point in the storytelling. I would sit at the back of the theater in the very last row and watch the audience's heads gradually descend like a wave that was receding back, you know, to the sea, lowering themselves in their seats with trepidation. I always got a kick out of it. I would bring people along and tell them, watch this. And it happened every time, this sea of heads gradually lowering until many heads you couldn't see any longer.
Boy, please, give me the ring and I won't say anything about it. Nobody has to hear anything about it. Your dad doesn't even have to know. Oh, God. I could never face him if he knew. Where is it? Give me the ring!
Oh, my goodness. Whatever happened to fade-outs and fade-ins and dissolves? I love them as transitional devices when they're properly used, but it seems that in today's movie-making, once again, they've gone the way of the Edsel. Now, this interior cottage set was created on stage. We recreated it on stage. And as the fire occurs in the next few moments, we cut back and forth from location to stage. Again, to me, without having storyboarded the picture from beginning to end, it would have been very difficult, I think, to maintain a real good sense of the visual and make these location stage blends work. I'm a firm believer in boarding.
What is the good of living when all that you love is gone? Even in death, she couldn't rest. I know. I see her roaming the cliffs at night, searching for her little girl, calling out her name. All these years.
This theme,
how well I've kept
behind it. Catherine's monologue, was the first theme that came to me musically. As I was creating the screenplay, I was sitting at the piano, working out melodies, and this became the theme for the film.
For you, my beloved sister.
Most people who've seen the film, I think, are not familiar with the fact or don't realize that I composed the score as well. Certainly that was the case throughout the industry. I intentionally took the scoring credit and put it at the end credit roll because it was just getting ridiculous. I had to take too many credits up front felt I had to put it at the end roll. And so many people didn't make the connection. Recently, the score has been released on CD with a marvelous CD-ROM program with stills from the film. And since this has occurred, the score has actually been reviewed in some periodicals, and glowingly, and I was so thrilled. My music. I made a determination here to have the cord that Len is strangling Catherine with already wrapped around her throat and have Catherine's position in the shot hide it. Again, I took a chance here because you never see him come over the top of her head with that cord. But again, I was after an effect here that, and it was an attempt at tricking the eye. And perhaps pointing to the fact that this man was just almost evil to the point of being a spiritual presence at this point. He could do anything. Catherine's dress actually caught fire in this scene, and it scared the hell out of us. I remember jumping upon her as she was at the side of the bed. She didn't realize it had happened, and smothering the fire. Again, these sequences involving the fire and the interior of the cottage were shot both location and stage in Los Angeles, and we ultimately had to make them all blend. And here we are, location. Camera was on a dolly, and we pulled back. And here we are with a lot of extensive matting involving the cliff action and the struggle atop the cliff. The cliff that we built on stage that Frankie and Phil were struggling atop was, oh, I'd say maybe about 12 feet high by maybe 15 feet wide. And below, there was nothing more than a big blue screen. Later, of course, we composited in the waves. Dear friend Karen Powell plays the Lady in White. I'd known Karen for, a good 10 years prior to making the film. Always considered her a marvelous actress. And when I asked her if she would do this for me, we were such good friends and she was so concerned that I was making the right decision that she tried to talk me out of hiring her. I practically had to beg her to realize she was right for this. And she did it, and has been immensely proud. As a matter of fact, there's a wonderful story that I like to relay. Shortly after the picture went to cable television and was released on video, she lives in New York, she was on the train, and seated next to two teenage girls who were speaking to one another, and one of them was conveying having seen the film the night before. And she was going on and on about how terrific the film was and defining the plot and everything that was going on in the movie, and she was just so breathless. Well, Karen overheard all of this, and she was sitting right next to them. And that hair of hers is hers. I mean, she looks very much, we did very little to create this look. That's Karen, and she very softly turned to this girl whose back was to her, who was speaking of the film, and tapped her on the shoulder and said, "Excuse me, I'm the Lady in White." Well, this girl let out a scream, jumped out of her seat, absolutely confirmed the fact that she was the Lady in White. The whole train almost came to a stop. Karen had to calm her down. Once again, I think, thematically speaking, here's the core of the film. Frankie reunites the little girl with her mother, and hopefully as a result comes to terms with the loss of his mother, and can now move on. I was criticized a bit for this sequence, bringing Phil back. I think that it was misunderstood. Certainly, there is another big shock, to endure when he does come back up the cliff. But it was essential for me to bring him back and have him confront Angela. And so it was absolutely necessary, although I will admit that I did take advantage of what I needed to do story-wise to give the audience another little jolt. But again, what's coming up is what was very, very important to me, and that is they're facing one another.
Take it!
This was a moment beautifully played, in my opinion, between the two of them.
No.
Philly, no!
And this was a blue screen shot with the clips and wave action matted in later. As a matter of fact, the clips and waves were shot day for night in Kauai, and then we added the sky as yet an additional optical element. This shot on the stage at our woods set, and the following shot location. I'm so pleased to have had the opportunity to share these comments with you. I hope you've enjoyed them. And I want to thank the people at Elite Entertainment for giving me the opportunity to preserve this moment in my life in a manner that I think is befitting and worthy. Have a great night.